Hi everyone. I'm joined today by Leslyn Keith, who is an expert in lymphedema, lipedema, and how to use ketogenic diets to improve these all too prevalent disease states. And we met Leslyn through Siobhan Huggins, who was talking on my podcast about lipedema. Which was shockingly an area that I didn't really know anything about, but that I don't want to steal your statistical thunder here, but that Siobhan said maybe about 9% of American women might be dealing with. And I think when people hear what it's like, that will shock them too. So welcome on, lovely to see you, and thanks for doing the work you're doing.
Thanks, Ellie. I'm really pleased to be here to talk to you about this. It's my passion, so I enjoy speaking about it, and I look forward to helping your audience to be more aware of this condition. They might then recognize it in their own family, friends, colleagues, and hopefully help other people.
Yeah. So, can you say a little bit about lymphedema and lipedema and how you got into that area?
Okay, so I'm an occupational therapist and I got special training in treating lymphatic and fat disorders. Specifically, lymphedema is where I started my career over 25 years ago. And I really focused on the care of lymphedema, which is specifically a lymphatic disorder where there is some kind of obstruction or blockage that keeps fluid from draining properly. And so this is like the other circulation besides the blood circulation. We also have lymph circulation. And when it can't get out of a body area, it creates swelling. And so I think the people will be most familiar with lymphedema as a result of breast cancer treatment. When you remove lymph nodes, radiate an area, cause lots of scar tissue, it creates an obstruction. So for instance, when you remove those nodes under the arm, then the fluid gets trapped in the arm, and it can also get trapped in the breast and the trunk area around that armpit area. So that backup and congestion and stagnation of fluid is called lymphedema. And I originally started pretty much just treating that condition, but gradually became aware of another condition that Siobhan talked to you about, which is lipedema, which it's not as clear cut what the origin of that fat disorder is, but it's that extraordinary fat deposition to the lower body and sometimes also to the arms, uncontrolled and expands to such a degree that it seems to be unaffected by typical weight loss measures and exercise. And then we get lymphatic disruption and pain and all kinds of things along with that fat expansion. But because of the lymphatic component to it, it was a condition that was also brought to my attention and was also, I've been treating that for quite a few years as well. I would say around 2011, 2012, I became aware of a ketogenic diet and just in general, how it was beneficial and probably the most effective for losing weight. But I started looking at it, well, it's good for losing weight, but is it also good for the lymphatics? Would it be good for people who are suffering from lymphedema and lipedema? And that just took off from there.
Yeah, so did you try it for yourself? Did you ever suffer from lipedema or lymphedema, if you don't mind me asking? You know, what was the test for keto there?
Yeah, and yes, I have done it myself. I do not have lymphedema or lipedema. In my immediate family, had people that were hypoglycemic and probably pre-diabetic. And so we were exploring different ways of eating to address that. As we were doing that, we found, this was from the research of Eric Westman and others, that this was the most efficacious method for losing weight. And at the time of my practice, probably 80% of my patients had obesity and morbid obesity along with lymphedema and lipedema. So I thought, okay, well, then this could be something that could help my patients address the obesity, not even thinking about addressing, you know, the conditions that I was most involved in treating, which was lymphedema and lipedema. I thought, well, this would just be a good weight loss method for them. And so I, of course, used it myself, adopted it in that time period, 2011, 2012. And I thought it was a fantastic way of eating and lots more energy, didn't have to stop to eat lunch, so I could work through lunch and just enjoyed that. And so then I started introducing it to several of my patients, several of them that I started with, the ones that were morbidly obese, because again, I was thinking of it only as a weight loss measure, not as a general health measure. And so I started introducing to them, and several of them were willing to try it. Others were, you've probably experienced this yourself, others were, are you sure you're not just trying to get rid of me? Are you trying to kill me with this way of eating that is opposite of everything we've been told is healthy? So, but the ones that were able to try it had spectacular results. And of course their lymphedema and their lipedema also improved, but I thought it was just a function of them losing weight. And then I had several patients that said, well, I don't really need to lose weight, but I'm just wondering, because there's lots of fat in my lymphedema arm, you know, the arm is secondary to breast cancer treatment. There's lots of fat that got deposited in that arm, but I'm not overweight otherwise. Would it help with that? Let me try it. And that's when it was like a total mind shift for me, because someone who didn't need to lose any weight ended up losing volume in the lymphedema arm just by using that diet and nothing else. And so that to me was like, wow, this is, I mean, I'm spending all this time doing this special massage and doing compression bandaging, and they're getting exercise and they're doing all this stuff. And the missing piece really for the treatment of their condition was nutrition. And so that got me really excited, and it was pretty much a turning point. I would say probably about in 2013, when I decided to get my doctorate, because I wanted to test using a ketogenic diet for people with lymphedema, and would it help them lose weight, but also have an impact, a favorable impact on their lymphedema. And so I finished that study in 2015. And that, like I say, started me down a different pathway, that it was more than just about weight loss. This is about general health, and specifically for the ones, the conditions I'm looking at, lymphatic health.
Hmm. And so what was the difference between treatment outcomes before keto and after?
So pretty spectacular. And so I had some just case study patients that, for instance, one patient, so she had did not need to lose weight. She had a pretty large arm after her breast cancer treatment. And she actually had a surgical treatment where they transplanted lymph nodes to the area that they had taken them out. And so in the hope that that would help drain the arm. And so I measured her, of course, before she had the surgery, measured her after the surgery, and we had a little bit of a decrease, not spectacular, but there was a little bit of decrease. And then about a year later, she said, okay, well, I'm going to try this way of eating. And so, so of course, we're keeping track of all the measurements. And then, so prior to starting keto, and then I would say probably about 6 months of keto, measurements again, and it was more of a decrease than after her surgery. Now, that surgery could have augmented what she did with the diet. We don't know, but anecdotally, it seemed like she had a greater response to the diet than she had to the surgery. So I had lots of patients like that that were using the way of eating with maybe they needed to lose 10 pounds at the most, but, you know, definitely. So they were overweight, but not obese or morbidly obese. And they were just getting this huge impact on the areas that where they had their lymphedema. And in my own study that I did, I was actually shocked that I had 10 people, and I thought, I'm just going to tell them why they should eat this way. And of course they're going to do it. So naive. So actually only six of them decided to do it and the other four did not. And I just, that didn't compute to me. I mean, why would you not do it? But that's human nature. We are not all going to do something just because the science tells us that that's what would be better. And so those four people were super apologetic to me. They said, we've just ruined your study. I said, no, you've actually made the differences even bigger, you know, because before I was just going to have 10 people all doing it and they would be their own control. But it was now these four people were really gave a comparison to using keto and not using keto. And in 10 different outcome measures, the difference between those two groups was astounding. And that was the first human participant study on keto and lymphedema. And now there's been much more since then. And still, because we can make an animal model of lymphedema, they still want to do lots of animal testing. I think there's still a fear about using this way of eating. And so we really got to do more on animals first. But it's really taken off in the field. And in 2015, well, from 2015 to 2017, I was going to conferences and talking about it. I was the only one who was talking about lymphatic and fat disorders and keto. Now the field is huge. You know, there's lots of people that are doing studies, doing research, and they're talking about it. So I'm not just this lone voice in the wilderness talking about this anymore. And the thing that I think is interesting with lipedema is there is no animal model for lipedema. So we can't test it on an animal first. So therefore, they're going right to women with lipedema, and especially in Europe. There has just in the last 5 years probably been at least a half a dozen clinical trials with lipedema and keto. And so we're really getting a good foundation of science, of the evidence that this is likely a good way to eat for that condition. Interestingly, even comparing like moderate carb or low carb versus keto. So we're finding all kinds of good stuff about carbohydrate restriction and lipedema, and that I'm hoping is going to spill into lymphedema because they're not doing so many human studies there. But it's so exciting because it's really out there now and it's getting to be more accepted.
Yeah, that's great. You know, in a way, I'm not surprised that the two things are looked at in a similar light, but in another sense, they do seem like quite different ailments. And, yes. In a way, it makes more sense that lipedema would be studied first. Surprising that there's no animal model. Maybe you could explain why, but also I think that because it's a fat illness, it's about adipose tissue, that keto would be a more natural conclusion to try than for lymphedema.
Yeah. And I think that, well, there's a lot of things coming into making that issue complex for lipedema. One is that there is a huge part of the medical community that doesn't believe it's even a condition, a bona fide condition. So these women are told that you are just fat. You just need to stop eating. You need to exercise more. And in truth, this population, they have exercised intensely for decades. They have gone on starvation diets. They have done, you know, things that probably even, mess them up metabolically even more because they were desperate to do something about the amount of adipose tissue on their body. And they took that thing that this is your fault. You are just fat and you can't control yourself like everybody else. They've taken that in and owned it and done everything they can until finally they give up. So they, even if they figure out about lipedema, they become aware of it. Their healthcare provider still isn't aware of it, most likely. And they're going to have that adversarial relationship with their healthcare provider, not believing them, not believing that they've made all these attempts to try to control their weight. So it is that I think is particularly difficult for that person with lymphedema versus someone who has breast cancer related lymphedema. The doctors all say, oh, of course, this is not your fault. This is because you were treated for breast cancer. And now we've got this outcome. And so, you know, so sorry, this is a lifelong condition, but it's not your fault. This is a medical condition. And that same way of thinking is not applied to lymphedema. So it, and that's another reason why, talking about the emotional aspects, the burden of having a condition like lymphedema and having a chronic condition that seemingly there's not much you can do about it is that's another area that's is a huge concern, because that's, you know, to not be believed and not be supported by your healthcare provider, that is adds a huge burden to the disease.
Yeah, and over and above the normal self-image crisis that people face when they don't feel in control of their body and they don't look the way they want to look.
Right.
Do you think 9% that Siobhan said is the right figure?
So, and this is an issue that we're trying to do something about too, because when you haven't really accurately defined the condition and it is not well accepted in the medical community, the research community, that it is a condition and what are the criteria, what are the characteristics of it, it's hard to come up with an incidence. And so depending on how you define it, you might get a widely varying incidence, but that 9 to 11% of the population worldwide, which could be 350 million women worldwide, that is what we're estimating at this point. It's hard to know, again, because we don't have a good definition.
So what are the proposed mechanisms for the cause of lymphedema?
So there is a definite research looking into the genetic causes, because we do seem to see it familial patterns. And then, you know, I think that muddying the water is, well, often, you know, if there's a familial pattern, you also have cultural influences on how you eat. Mm-hmm. So, but it could very well be that there is a gene or a cluster of genes that lead to a propensity for lower body fat, even beyond, you know, the pear-shaped obesity that women are more predisposed to than men. And so that excessive adipose tissue deposition, you might have a gene that can lead to that, but it's only in the area of if you have that environmental exposure that will produce that will support that. So like a Western diet, very high carbohydrate Western diet. There's also, we're also looking at the hormonal influences, because it seems like the typical onset for lymphedema symptoms is puberty, pregnancy, and menopause. And so is there sex hormones involved? Those are also time periods when we're naturally insulin resistant. So is insulin involved? There's a high incidence of hypothyroidism in lymphedema. And so is thyroid hormone involved? And so it could be, you know, a cluster of genes. It could be a combination of different hormones that are doing it. Right now, again, I think the one thing that's stopping really good research on lymphedema is that we don't have a clear definition of what should be the inclusion and exclusion criteria for women to be studied. How do we say that you have lymphedema and you don't? So we need to clearly define that so that we can do studies. And typically right now, even with not knowing that perfectly, there's very small sample sizes. But if we all agree on particular inclusion criteria, then we can mass all these studies together and maybe learn even more. But at this point, it's you're massing together apples and oranges and pears, so that we are not really, you can't really get good data out of that.
What are some of the proposed inclusion criteria?
So it's actually right now in the last 5 years, there's quite a disagreement in the lymphology community about it. And there is definitely a faction that says that the term, the title lipedema is actually a misnomer, because there is no edema in lipedema. It's a fat disorder and there's no lymphatic involvement. There's no swelling. That is not, I'm a member of the community that says, no, there's a definite lymphatic component. So it's something as basic as that, that there's not agreement on that. And I think that there is mounting evidence that there is lymphatic component because of specialized imaging techniques, that we can see excess fluid in the interstitial space. We can see anomalies and impairments to lymphatic functioning. So I think that there is evidence to that, but it's not solidified. And so there is lots of areas of contention. There's also a faction that says that women with lipedema all have a mental disorder, and that mental disorder caused the fat to proliferate and the condition to develop, which I think a lot of women with lipedema find that particularly offensive. But there definitely, that is another faction. So it's quite a bit of disagreement, and sometimes at conferences it can get quite contentious. But I think that you need to have these arguments and disagreements, and you need to get them out there so that more people are involved in the discussion and can help us learn and to come in to better conclusions.
Mm-hmm. Is there typically scarring involved around fat tissue and lipedema?
Yeah, in lipedema, there is definitely scarring and fibrosis that develops in the later stages. And sometimes even in the in not so later stages, you can see, if you've ever seen a picture of legs that have lipedema, the skin appears dimpled, kind of mattress-like. And that is, we believe, because of the scar tissue binding down the tissue and the skin in various spots and not in others. And so it looks, can look very lumpy like that because of the scar tissue. So interestingly, a ketogenic diet can help reduce that fibrosis, but it's not standalone. You also need some manual techniques that can help with that as well. It really requires both conditions, lymphedema and lipedema, require a holistic approach that I believe nutrition is a huge part of, but you also need to wear compression garments and to, you know, exercise and all the various other components to your care. But I feel like if you don't set yourself up with good nutrition, that all the other things you try to use to manage your condition are not going to be as effective.
Mm. There's usually a vocal component of any group that some of whom have seemed to have done well using diet and lifestyle to control the ailment, that the small vocal group thinks that it's a kind of snake oil, that they see other people saying they're getting better and think, oh, well, maybe they never had it in the first place. Does that exist in the community?
Oh, very much so, very much so. And so I think when we first started trying this out and putting the word out about using a ketogenic diet for lipedema especially, people were excited. And so, you know, they just said, here's my story. This might work for you too. And you're telling this to a group of women who have tried every diet out there. And there was a certain faction of them who said, you're telling me that I have to try this other diet when nothing else has worked. And so therefore, if I don't try it, you're saying it's my fault that I have, you know, and it was just from decades of being abused, that this became for some people a hard pill to swallow, to say, okay, I have to try another diet just to show that it doesn't work for me. And then there's also the variability on the effects, because we're so different and in our metabolic health can vary, that, you know, you can have two women with lipedema about the same size and everything, and then have them both try the diet, and it's going to work better for one than the other. And when you compare your results, you start thinking that, okay, there's this not just a universal application of this diet and then it's going to work. And so I think that's why it's so important to work with a coach, because we have the basic framework of what it means to be use carbohydrate restriction, to use a ketogenic diet. But now we need to tailor it to you specifically, because there are plenty of foods that are considered keto that person may have an intolerance for, that may increase their swelling, for instance, make their inflammation go up and make the condition worse. So I think we need to look at the basic framework of carbohydrate restriction and using a ketogenic diet, and then now tailor it specifically to that person. Not meaning that I just can't think of anybody that reducing their carbohydrates wouldn't be good for, but the amount of protein and the amount of fat and the specific foods might vary, or and probably will vary.
Yeah. And I guess the specific fats as well, because sometimes I think in the old days, keto was thought of as an epilepsy diet where you had to chug lots of oil. And yes. Most people are aware of the potential damage of seed oils, vegetable oils now, but that they sneak in.
Yes.
So mayonnaise, for example, you know, if you get a big jar of Hellmann's mayonnaise, then it's, you know, it's keto, but it might be inflammatory and obesogenic. And actually,
yeah, I think of that guy in Sweden, I think Tommy. He was, you know, uber obese, and he lived on mayonnaise, and he, you know, lost like 200 pounds. So for him, it was okay. But for a lot of people, it might be inflammatory and cause their condition to worsen.
Yeah. And, you know, that emotional component is so important. It's, you know, people aren't machines. You're not just switching a lever or a dial. And, you know, you spoke earlier about ones that were able to try it, and there's barriers to trying these things. So, like, besides people who just don't believe it will work or feel affronted because they've tried every diet under the sun, you know, now when you tell people that it works from data, do you still get people deciding not to do it, and why?
Yeah, I think one is that I've already tried a bunch of things. Don't make me have to try something else. I'm accepting the way my body is. I'm going to manage it the best I can, and I'm not going to go that direction. The other is that I think that we live in a very plant-based society for the most part, and there is a definite fear of animal-sourced foods. There is a huge faction of the population that even for religious or other reasons, cultural reasons, that they're going to only want to do a plant-based diet. And so they're going to say, okay, so I'm going to do a ketogenic diet, but it's going to be vegan. And which I think is impossible, very, very, very hard. And so then they don't get the results. So then therefore, okay, for me, a ketogenic diet doesn't work. And I think it is really based in that fear of eating animal sourced foods, fear of fat in a lot of cases, although even in the lipedema community, when we know that using low carb, high fat is so good at reducing adipose tissue, there's a variability on how much fat you should consume when you have lipedema because of the lymphatic component. And so, if they go overboard and really have a lot of fat in their diet, it also, again, may not work. And so they feel like, okay, that's proof that this is not working for me because I did the diet to the letter and it didn't work. Matter of fact, it caused increased abdominal bloating or whatever. So we had no idea what we were doing. So we just said, we used that epilepsy diet. We said, do it like this, try it out. We don't know. and people were trying it and a lot of them were successful, but some, were not. And again, they took it on themselves. They said, it's my fault. It doesn't work for me. And so I think we've learned from that it really takes coaching from a keto expert to help someone find their way within that framework, because there is going to be such a huge variability and a huge of, just even your preferences, what you like. I can't tell you how many patients that have told me, I get nauseous looking at fat on my plate, And so you have that visceral reaction to what you think you're supposed to try eating, and that's not good. So we need to work with those personal needs and preferences.
Yeah, that's huge, isn't it? To make it sustainable, you better like it. And there's always something that people can find that they like. Whether they think that it's good for them is another thing, isn't it? Because I've heard clients say, red meat just doesn't agree with my system. And I wonder sometimes whether there's a down regulation in stomach acid over years of not getting enough nutrition. There might be small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. There might be, all sorts of other things that make it difficult to digest food. And so they've found themselves in a position where they're more comfortable eating whatever feels, there's no pain or, but actually they're missing out on a lot of nutrition as a result. And it can be hard to suggest to people that there's a way back from that.
Yes. Yeah. And you also wonder about the addiction aspect, that is quite a barrier, a physical barrier. I think that people may think that that's only an emotional or mental barrier, but there is a biology to it. And I think that always wanting to go, I was just talking to a person that was, he said, I was okay giving up alcohol, I was okay giving up sugar, but I can't give up my coffee. And so what is it in that drink? And he said, I haven't been drinking it for 6 months. There's not a day that goes by that I go, I just wish I could have a cup of coffee. So, but he has found that whatever it is in the coffee, the caffeine or whatever, causes a bad reaction to him. So he, even though he has experienced that bad reaction, that urge, that compulsion to have it is still there. And, and that is, I believe, a biological situation that causes you so much mental distress that we call it a mental thing, but I think it's rooted in physiology.
Yeah. I like what Mark Twain said about smoking. Quitting smoking is easy. I've done it hundreds of times.
That's right.
And I've definitely had an issue with food and cigarettes in the past in that regard. And, I worked with Jen Unwin on her Clubhouse about food addiction. And she's got a brilliant book about that, Fork in the Road. And
And would you say food addiction or particular foods?
It really varies.
You can't be addicted to all foods because we need to eat.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why some people have an issue with the term addiction, because it is different from a drug addiction. It's some people who feel addicted to certain foods, they kind of lament the fact that they can't just stop eating. Maybe they're in a 12-step program for alcohol or drugs or something else, and they don't need those things to live, so they can get used to it. It's hard, but you have to
doing
eat.
Abstinence, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it's a messed up situation, because evolution would have been silly if it hadn't made healthy food moorish and delicious. But we've gamed that, haven't we? So that there's foods that and drinks and that are drug like you know, and our drugs like coffee, tea, and we get very attached to them physically, and we build up dopamine pathways around the anticipation of doing it. So that the anticipation of doing it is really where a lot of the dopamine's derived from, rather than the act. Then the physical effects of doing it afterwards. And it all just reinforces so heavily. You can build an identity around these things. And when you look at the list of things that people often have to give up, bread, pasta, caffeine, sweets, anything with sugar in it. And then sometimes even like, you know, more triggers, dairy is a big one. I don't know if you find dairy for lipedema and lymphedema are big triggers potentially, but all those things, and it can seem like there's nothing left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have found though that if they don't have a barrier to eating meat, that and animal source fats and stuff like that, animal proteins, that they do discover that the satiation and the wonderful taste of those foods, that they don't miss the bitterness of many plants. So I no longer have to eat kale or, you know, all that actually are low carb, but I now can really focus on the things that taste good to me. I've had a couple patients that are thrilled that they now can have bacon and not feel bad about it because they like the taste of it. So I think it does help to listen to your taste and hopefully have, you know, then a compulsion, a desire to eat those things that are actually going to be. So I have no need to eat something that tastes bitter and unpalatable.
It's kind of thing that it's hard to explain to people if they've been through so much with it, where they've been gaslit by their healthcare providers, where they've been told one thing repeatedly, that it's their fault, and that there's this fresh new hope, and that it also means giving up what for a lot of people is a comfort in their lives, or it feels like a comfort in their lives. So it's amazing, really, that
when you're having a chronic condition, and there's so much that makes you not feel good, that when you can think of particular food items that make you feel good, you don't want to give those up.
Yeah. Yeah, it's completely understandable. So it is amazing that people end up trying it in the first place, because to me it shows there's always hope. People always have some hope there, and that's a great thing.
Yeah, we've just seen anecdotally, as well as in studies, the spectacular results of using a ketogenic diet that's been tailored to that person. The results have been spectacular for, you know, and for someone with lipedema who had no way of reducing their pain, but no way of reducing the size of their body, no way of increasing their energy level. and then they use this way of eating, and that happens, it's life changing.
Mm-hmm. And when did you start your conference?
So I've been working with Lipedema Simplified since probably about 2017. And in 2019, we had our first virtual conference. And I think what we have coming up in October is probably about our sixth or seventh event. And so, and it is a virtual conference for lipedema and lymphedema. And we really are discussing a holistic view of the conditions, and of which ketogenic eating is one part, but we're also not ignoring the other aspects of the conditions. And so what we've done with the last probably three or four iterations of this conference is that we really want to make it a interactive community event. So we have experts such as yourself who will be there, but it's still, we have interaction between the attendees and the sponsors and the speakers, and so we can all learn more. I always said that when I work with my patients, and I learn as much from them as they learn from me, because people are living in their bodies 24/7 and they figure out how to cope and how to thrive. And so they've got brilliant ideas. And so we wanted to have a way to bring everybody together to share, you know, what they found works, what makes them happier.
Brilliant. And that's the interactive side has come out, you were telling me, a lot more recently. Mm-hmm. The interaction with the audience members, that it's something that it's clear from the feedback that they really value.
Yes. Yes. I think that, you know, our first iteration was just, we speak, you listen. And there was a minimal interaction, but the participants are want to be involved. They want to be engaged. I mean, you can fall asleep just watching a conference for 3 days and you're not going to get anything out of it. So we've done all we can to get people engaged to be able to participate. So it's going to be happening this October, 27, 28, 29, all virtual. And if you buy the higher level package, you get all the replays. So if you can't be there for, I think it goes like 8 or 9 hours a day for those 3 days, you get the replay so that you can be able to rewatch or watch the first time various aspects of the conference. It's going to be a wonderful event.
That's great. And who is it aimed at? Who? What kind of makeup do you expect in the audience?
So it's predominantly going to be people who have the condition of lymphedema or lipedema. You can have them both. But we also have a significant portion of our attendees are healthcare providers, family members, caregivers, and then, of course, all of our sponsors are intensely interested in the condition as well. And so we have, quite a mix, but I would say predominantly people who have the conditions themselves are going to be making up the audience.
And what kind of response have you got from doctors and healthcare providers?
So many of our speakers are going to be physicians and healthcare providers. But it's still, particularly for lipedema, as I was saying, not a well-recognized condition. But I would tell you, when we go to low-carb conferences and talk to healthcare providers in that setting, they are intensely interested and do not discount it as, oh, this is just another, you know, obesity situation. They are very, very interested, and we felt very well accepted in that low-carb community. And it's starting to be more accepted in, for instance, a lot of the obesity medical societies, like the Obesity Society and the Obesity Medicine Association. You will see out of a weekend conference, they might have one or two presentations on lymphedema. So they're starting to accept it in that community. We're wheedling our way in there. But I would say that there's no community that's more accepting than a low-carb community. So we've really enjoyed interacting in that community, not only because they support the way of eating, but also because they're so accepting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a broad church, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Very much so. And I think that there is, now we've gone this direction of, it's a wide tent of what is going to be the acceptable way to eat. I think with the foundation of restricting carbs, but now where do we go from there? Do we need to have electrolyte supplementation? Do we need to have certain types of fats? I mean, that is... The low-carb community seems to be open to those types of discussions and variations.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And, you know, Siobhan's very sort of curious and careful person around that sort of thing, and very open-minded about what might work and, you know, novel spins on ketogenic diets.
Yes. Siobhan does incredible self-experimentation and takes very careful documentation data on what she is doing. So, and I think sacrificing her body for some of her experiments, but she has been able to share with the lymphedema and lymphedema community what she's found out. And she's not making any claim that this is how what it's going to be for everybody, but I took this chance and I tried this out and this is what happened. And some of her experiments, like I say, I think were pretty hard on her body, but she learned a lot from it. And we are lucky enough to benefit from what she learned.
Yeah. And do you have a sense when people go on a ketogenic diet, you know, even though there's not one type of ketogenic diet, but what percentage of people are getting better with lymphedema and lymphedema and to what extent?
I would say, so let's look at just, we have a Facebook group, Keto for Lymphedema Lifestyle is our Facebook group. We have about 14,000 members. And I would say probably about 90% of those members have had some type of success, whether it is, you know, for just the pain reducing or whatever. So they've had some type of success. It may not be the extent or the type of success they want. And I would say the number one type of success that they want is to lose weight. They just want to see the scale go down. And really you can see the scale go down with any way of eating. You just, you know, any kind of starvation diet, the scale will go down, but will you be healthy and will you lose fat on your lower body if you have lymphedema? And I say no, unless you restrict carbohydrates. But unfortunately, even in that group, the Keto Lifestyle for Lymphedema Facebook group, if they don't see the scale go down, even though the pain is better, their clothes are looser, every energy is better, all those things are good, but the scale has not gone down, they are very disappointed. It wasn't the outcome that they were looking for. And so, and I know this is probably something you do in your coaching, is that you're trying to get people to look at all different aspects of success. It's not just measured on the scale. That's a hard thing for our very scale focused society.
Yeah, absolutely. And for some people, when we start the conversation in the first session, they're quite tentative because they think the process is going to be, this is what I'm telling you to eat, and this is how we're going to measure your success. And when I ask them, what do they want to eat and how do they want to measure the success, then sometimes they're just taken aback because they didn't realize that might be part of the process, you know. And some people don't want to use the scale. Some people are so traumatized by thinking about things in pounds that yes. they just want to use kilograms, or vice versa.
Yes.
Or they're quite happy at measuring their waist circumference because they've never done that before, so they don't have yes. all that emotional baggage around it.
Yes.
Or they just want to think about a particular garment. You know, a lot of people have this kind of salad days garment that they just want to fit back into.
Yes.
And when they do, it's such a great moment. And there's all sorts of different things, and you get no idea until you ask someone why they feel the way they do about their weight, about their body in other ways, about food. And so I just think, you know, you can't assume anything. And I think that's true about needing coaching of some description, because people walk around with damaging assumptions about themselves and the world. And all it needs is a gentle challenge to help them to realize that they don't need to be carrying that.
Yes. I know, thinking about that in my patients with lymphedema and lipedema, and that's when we go through a course of treatment and we need to come up with goals. The insurance wants to know, what are you going to achieve? And therefore then we'll pay for the treatment. And so a big part of that process is to ask the patient, what is your goal? I have a patient who has lymphedema in their leg because of melanoma treatment. And the leg is really, really large and the foot is large. And they haven't been able to wear normal shoes in a decade. Their goal is to reduce enough that they can wear the same size shoe in both feet. Fantastic goal. And that could be for a woman with lipedema, that her whole life she's had such huge legs. Foot is small, but the calf is so huge. She's never been able to wear those fashionable boots that all her girlfriends wore, these nice, knee-high boots. And so her goal is, I want to wear a boot like everybody else. And so that, you know, like you're saying, to having those kinds of measures, that it's not the scale, and it's also something that they came up with themselves. This is what means something to me to achieve that.
Yeah. And there can be a hard time coming to terms with the reality of some damage that won't go away, I guess.
Yes.
Because the nature of lipedema and lymphedema is sometimes that there's a limit, right?
Yes.
To recovery possible.
Yes. Yeah. And so, there is, at some point, there's irreversible tissue damage. And so we've seen women who were, you know, advanced stage lipedema, very, very large, and they, on the scale, might have lost 150 pounds. They still have a pear shape to their body. Their skin has been stretched to the degree that it's now saggy and loose and maybe not what they would consider sightly. And so you get to a certain point and yes, you're healthier and you're smaller, but it's not like a complete reversal, like you have no evidence that you ever had lipedema. And that's unfortunate, and why we want to get people aware of the conditions and get them the proper treatment much, much sooner. One reason why they're looking for a gene is that, you know, so my mom has lipedema. Can I, you know, can the daughter get tested and see if she has the propensity to develop lipedema as well? You know, those types of things that can help us address this early and quickly, and maybe not even put someone in the environment that they would develop the condition.
Yeah, well, more power to you and your work. I'm really glad to be able to speak at the conference at the end of October, and looking forward to it. And I'll be talking about my experience of the mental health benefits of using ketogenic diets and some of the subjects around that. So where can people find your work? You mentioned the name of the website earlier, or the name of the organization.
Yes. So there's a couple of websites. One is Lipedema Simplified. So it's lipedema-simplified.org. And then our nonprofit arm that really focuses on research is lipedemaproject.org. And so I'm assuming you'll probably have links to both of those. I of course love talking to people. And if anybody has any questions, they can contact me at my email, which is leslin@lipedemaproject.org. Happy to help people get the resources and everything that they need to get the better care, more awareness, more information. That's what we're all about. So those two websites, come to our conference, email me. I'd love to talk to people.
Brilliant. Well, I really appreciate your time, Leslin, and thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, everyone, for listening or watching the Ali Houston Transforms podcast. Please hit subscribe where you're watching or listening so you don't miss out on future episodes. And please do leave a review. It takes about 10 seconds and it really helps to get the messages out there. And if you or anyone you know could benefit from a mental health tune-up, then head over to metsci.com, where myself and psychiatrist Dr. Rachel Brown coach you to better mental health.